Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 159, Hollywood Therapist to the Stars, June 20th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think at a psychological level, I learned that, for me at least, living authentically was really, really important. And I learned as a patient in therapy that if I were going to live authentically, I was going to have to change my life a little bit. And there was a period in my early 30s before I went back to school where I lived in Nepal for 4 months in the Himalayas and started meditating and did a lot of spiritual reading and work. And what I learned was that there was a whole part of me that was deeper and more questing than was being served by my career in show business.
That was the voice of my guest, Dennis Palumbo. Dennis Palumbo, MA and MFT, is a writer and licensed psychotherapist in private practice specializing in creative issues. He's the author of Writing from the Inside Out, as well as a new collection of mystery short stories, From Crime to Crime. Formerly a Hollywood screenwriter, his credits include the feature film My Favorite Year, for which he was nominated for a WGA Award for Best Screenplay. He was also a staff writer for the ABC TV series Welcome Back, Kotter, and has written numerous series episodes and pilots. He's the author of a novel, City Wars, and his short fiction has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, The Strand, and elsewhere. He provides feature articles and reviews for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Emmy Magazine, and many others. His column, The Writer's Life, appeared monthly for 6 years in Written By, the magazine of the Writers Guild of America. Currently, he's a contributing writer to The Lancet, Britain's leading medical journal, and does commentary for NPR's All Things Considered. Dennis conducts workshops throughout the country. Recent appearances include the Family Therapy Network Annual Symposium, the Association for Humanistic Psychology, California State Northridge University, the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and the Writers Guild Foundation, the Los Angeles Psychoanalytic Society, and the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, and the Directors Guild and UCLA. A graduate of the University of Pittsburgh and Pepperdine University, he serves on the faculty of UCLA Extension, where he was named Outstanding Teacher of the Year. Now, here's the interview. Dennis Palumbo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Nice to be here.
It's such a small world. I heard you give a fascinating interview on a Los Angeles National Public Radio affiliate. And my first thought was, I've got to get this guy for my show. And then my second thought was, I'll bet he knows my friend and former student, Dr. Ron Alexander. And it turns out you do.
That's right. We were in a supervision group together for a number of years.
Isn't that amazing? It is such a small world.
Yeah, I think the clinical world can be kind of a small world sometimes, too.
Yeah, and Ron and I have kept touch over the years, and we've done a number of workshops together here and in the U.S. and in Europe. Now, you're a Hollywood screenwriter turned psychotherapist.
That's right.
And, you know, I think it would be the rare person who hasn't, at some point in their life, dreamed of going to Hollywood and making it in one way or another. So let's start with your history as a screenwriter. How did you end up in Hollywood?
Well, I came out to Hollywood, I guess I was 24, 25, something like that, and I wanted to write for film and television. And I had a hard time getting anyone to read my material, and so believe it or not, at the time, what I heard was that a lot of producers and studio executives and agents would go down to the Comedy Store and hire people who were doing stand-up. So I worked up a stand-up act, and I did it at the Comedy Store. And so I hung out with Freddie Prinze and, you know, David Letterman and, you know, I don't know whatever happened to those bums. and did stand-up very badly for about a year and a half. I thought, good material, but I never had that killer instinct, you know.
What cojones you have? I think that is one of the, to me, one of the scariest things that a person could do. I mean, I've had that fantasy for myself years back when I used to think I was funnier than I think I am now. But the thought of getting up there, you know, and doing that, boy, that must have taken some courage.
Well, it's a rough crowd. I mean, the thing is, if you come up with a guitar or a flute, people go, wow, you know, this guy can do something. But if you just stand there by yourself, it's almost as though the audience sits back with their arms folded and says, you know, I've got an Uncle Buddy who's funnier than this.
Yes.
You know, and so it's really a kind of an adversarial relationship at first.
Exactly.
Which is very difficult. And then you have to win them over. But luckily, I never wanted to be a stand-up comic. It was never my goal. I wanted people to see that I could be funny. And ultimately what happened is Gabriel Kaplan, who was starring in a show at the time called Welcome Back, Kotter, saw my act and liked it. And so he asked me, he said exactly the same thing that the club owner said. He said, you have great material and you're a terrible comic. And so with these words of encouragement ringing in my ears, I went on the road with Gabe and wrote his stand-up act while he was on hiatus from Welcome Back, Kotter's first season.
Well, that's fascinating.
And then in the second season, I had begun writing with a partner at that point, and we managed to get on the show, Welcome Back, Kotter, as story editors. And that's how my TV writing career began. And we did that show for a couple years. And then I went off by myself and started writing screenplays and was very lucky to sell my favorite year. So I was a screenwriter about 15 years, I guess. And very fortunate, you know.
Where had you grown up, and what did you major in?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And my dad was a grocer, and nobody in my family knew what a writer was. And, you know, so the plan for me, I think, was to be, I was the first of nine grandchildren and the first one to go to college. And I think the operating understanding was I was either going to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, or fallback position was always priest. But as it turned out, I left engineering school to become a writing major. And difficult time for my family. I mean, they began lighting novena candles for my soul the moment I said I was going to try to break into show business. So, but I was very lucky.
Wow.
I think I was very lucky. I mean, I worked hard, but I just thought I had a lot of good breaks along the way.
Well, that's interesting that you were going to be an engineer. I also was originally accepted into school as an electrical engineer, and I switched out to major in creative writing. But I did not go on to Hollywood.
We have exactly the same undergraduate path, it looks like.
Yeah, it does sound that way. So then at some point, you made a transition into becoming a therapist. How did that happen?
Well, I'll give you the 5-minute version. It was a long, protracted, angst-filled journey. But the short version is I had been in therapy myself for a while, and my first marriage had ended, and I was really just so excited and blown away by the therapy process. And I think, frankly, I'd really not gotten in touch with my own feelings and my own issues. And here I was in my mid-30s in therapy for the first time. And, you know, the first time I went into therapy, I said to the therapist, look, you know, don't get too attached to me. I'll be out of here in one or two sessions, you know. And, 16, 17 years later? anyway, I fell in love with the process, so I started volunteering at psychiatric facilities and clinics and going back to school to Pepperdine to get my master's. I wasn't you know, it wasn't one of those things where, oh, gee, I'm going to leave screenwriting and become a therapist. I still, you know, was working during the day. I was taking meetings and writing scripts and, you know, developing television pilots. But I was going to school at night at Pepperdine. And once I got my master's, I realized, well, why don't I just keep going? And you know, you need in California, as you know, 3,000 clinical intern hours before you can even sit for the test. And I thought, well, I don't know if I'm going to do that, but I might as well keep working. So I went to work at a low-fee family clinic and also at a psychiatric facility. And over the years, I saw how much I loved doing this work. And then finally, one day I had a kind of road to Damascus experience. It's a little corny, but it's true. I was having lunch with a producer at this restaurant in Los Angeles, and he was trying to get me interested in doing this film with him. And I kept looking at my watch because I thought I was going to be late to get to the psychiatric hospital where I was leading schizophrenics in group therapy. And I got out of the lunch. I'm racing down La Cienega to get to the psychiatric hospital, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? I can't wait to get where I'm going, and I couldn't wait to be leaving where I was. And that's when I realized, my God, I do want to change my life.
Mm.
And so I ended up finishing up my internship and taking the orals and the written, and I got licensed and retired from show business. And so it was. It took a while. It was like 6.5 years because I was working at the same time. But then I went into private practice, and at the time, everyone was saying, "Boy, you better specialize," which is, you know, really true now for therapists.
Yes.
And I figured the thing I knew best was being an entertainment professional. So I opened my practice, and I specialized in creative issues. And so my practice has grown now, and I have writers and directors and actors, and I've been very, very lucky again. You know, I think I feel a particular niche because I'm sort of uniquely qualified in the sense that I can work with creative people and have been through almost everything they've been through. You know, if someone comes to me and says, gee, I'm really anxious about pitching this series idea to NBC. Well, I pitched NBC 1,000 times, so I know exactly what they're concerned about. And so my practice is interesting in the sense that often people come to me because of creative issues like writer's block or procrastination or fear of failure or whatever. But within, you know, easily a half dozen sessions, we're doing family of origin stuff, we're doing their relationship issues, substance abuse. It's sort of regular therapy with a particular bent, which is my patients have the usual issues everyone has, except they're struggling in one of the most difficult, arbitrary, and maddening businesses on the planet.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit about that before we go more into the therapy. Let me ask you about your own experience when you were working in Hollywood as a creative person. What were the rewards of being a screenwriter, first of all?
Well, I think the rewards were twofold. Initially, when you start writing, or at least when I started writing, you think the reward is, wow, it'll be so great to see my words on screen, to see my name on screen. One of the particular pleasures of being on a weekly series like Welcome Back, Kotter, for example, is, you know, you would write a script and the actors would rehearse it that week and they would shoot it, and 3 weeks later it would be on television and all your relatives would see it, you know. So there's that immediate gratification. I think what happens over time when, because you're a writer, you know, especially once I became a screenwriter, you're very powerless as a screenwriter. You don't have much control over what happens to your script, and you have to execute a lot of notes that people give you even if you don't agree with them. And what happens, and it's a subtle change, but I think it's the one that most mature writers go through, is the gratification becomes personal. In other words, it's the process of writing that becomes its own reward, where you do the very best you can and you be as truthful a writer as you can, and tell the story the way you want to tell the story, and then hope for the best. You know, you can't control whether, you know, you've written a story for a man and they've decided to put Reese Witherspoon in the part. You can't control that. But the only thing you can control is the integrity and sincerity with which you're writing your material. And so I think what happens for most writers, and it certainly happened for me, the rewards become the work. You know, the problem solving, the mm-hmm. being in the world of the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it sort of goes out into the world, and it's like sending your child out into the world. You know, you do the best you can. You hope to God things go well.
Yeah, I can understand that. And maybe you're alluding to this next question, which is, what were the frustrations? What was it about this job that kind of drove you crazy and ultimately out of that business?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of frustrations. Any screenwriter will tell you that. I mean, the most, you know, striking frustration is you don't control your material. You see, if you're a playwright and you're a member of the Dramatists Guild, no actor or director or producer can change a word of your play without your approval. Whereas in screenwriting, writers do not hold copyright on their material. So from the moment you pitch an idea to a studio and they purchase it, they own it. And you're then their employee. And as a result, they can change it or do anything they want to with it, and they can include in kicking you off your own movie, which happens every day. And so the frustration is, I think, boils down to the fact that I believe screenwriters are the most crucial aspect of a movie, and they're the ones with the least power and the least control.
Yeah, I found that fascinating
when I heard you discuss that before. Yeah, it's really strange. Now, in television, it's a little different. If you're television, in my practice, to be honest with you, the happiest writers in my practice are TV writers, and the least happy writers are screenwriters. I think because in television, particularly if you create a show and you become the showrunner or the executive producer, you're the boss. Even though you have to deal with networks and you have to deal with the censor and you have to be worried about ratings, you control the writing. The writing all goes through you. And unlike in movies where the director is the king, in television the director is the hired hand. He comes on and does an episode or two or three, but he's an employee. And so if you become a very well-known showrunner like, you know, Stephen Bochco or David Kelly or someone like that, those television shows belong to you. And the directors and the actors work for you. I mean, I think probably the most well-known case is Dick Wolf with the Law & Order series.
Right, right. We're big fans of
that. Because if he has a problem
family.
With an actor, he just dumps them. You know, I mean, it's unlike certain types of TV shows where the audience is there because of the actor. Law & Order is a franchise that's all about the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the cast is unhappy, they can go, because they'll just replace them with another lawyer. And it's about the writing. And so Dick Wolf would never have that kind of power in a film. If you're making a film with Tom Cruise and you and he have an argument over the material, guess which one of you gets kicked off? It's going to be you.
Yeah.
The star has all the power.
I had a kind of eye-opening insight into that. I was sort of alerted to it, I guess, by hearing you speak in that other interview that I alluded to. I was watching the director's cut, you know, the latest version of Blade Runner,
mm-hmm.
Which is out on a DVD, and then they've got all these stuff that you can, you know, all the feature stuff about the making of Blade Runner. And
right.
It was amazing how it started as one guy's idea, and he did all the writing, and then they brought in another writer and changed it all around, you know, from his original vision. And he kind of
That happens all the time. I mean, if look at a film like Tootsie, it had 23 screenwriters working on it.
Amazing.
Yeah. And when they had to do the arbitration for, you know, who would finally get credit on the film, apparently the rumor is that like 3 boxes of screenplays were delivered to the Writers Guild. This is before computers, you know. It's just this image of all these boxes of screenplays coming in.
Oh, my goodness.
But most screenplays, especially now with big movies, you know, they're so expensive. I understand, I don't know for sure, but I understand, for example, with Iron Man, there were 2 sets of screenwriters writing 2 separate screenplays, and the director was sort of taking one from column A and one from column B and cobbling the movie together.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, screenwriters really are, you know, really fodder in the movie business. But there's still tremendous reward. I mean, you know, when your film gets made, there's nothing like seeing your name on screen. And if as much of it as possible gets salvaged, it's really exciting.
I often think when I'm sitting in the movies and the credits are rolling by at the end, you know, and sometimes in some of the, with all the special effects and everything in some of these blockbuster movies, the credits roll on forever.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, and as an audience, if we hang around for the screen credits, we're probably sitting there kind of bored or looking for interesting names. But I always kind of pause to reflect that all those people there, the quotes, little people, you know, are, mm-hmm. are in some theater with their family saying, look, look, there's my name.
There's my name, that's right.
Yeah.
My feeling is credits exist for relatives.
Yes.
So we should all sit and watch. You
know? Right, right. So the Dennis Palumbo, the early years, what did you learn about yourself through this process of, you know, being a stand-up comedian, then being a screenwriter? What did you learn about yourself?
I think I learned a couple things. Number one, I learned that if I really worked hard, you know, that thing Ben Hogan, the golfer, said, I think is true, that the harder you work, the luckier you get. Because I often used to just ascribe a lot of my success as a writer, you know, to luck. But then I thought about how hard I worked and how I wrote every day and how much I worried and everything. So I came away with a sense of, yeah, if you really, really work hard, it doesn't guarantee anything, but it increases your chances of success. I think at a psychological level, I learned that, for me at least, living authentically was really, really important. And I learned as a patient in therapy that if I were going to live authentically, I was going to have to change my life a little bit. And, you know, I went through an enormous amount of sort of stereotypical types of behavior. I mean, I ended up, you know, one of the, a film I had been working on about a mountain climber named Willie Unsolt required that I go all over the world and, you know, climb mountains. I, you know, climbed the Grand Teton and Mount Rainier and ended up in Asia. And finally, I even though the film didn't move forward, I fell in love with that kind of travel. And there was a period in my early 30s before I went back to school where I lived in Nepal for 4 months in the Himalayas and started meditating and did a lot of spiritual reading and work. Mm-hmm. And what I learned was that there was a whole part of me that was deeper and more questing than was being served by my career in show business. That the more authentic I felt as a person, the less authentic I felt in my career in show business. And this is not to put down a career in show business. You can be quite authentic and live in show business. But how I'm constituted, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. So for me, being a therapist seems like coming home to a place that I was waiting for a long time, which is to live in a world of feelings. And less a world where I had to perform to get love. And I think my show business career was a lot about, you know, handing in a script and hoping for an A, if you know what I mean.
Yes, definitely.
And no matter how much they loved it, they never loved it enough. You know, it was a hole that wasn't getting filled. And I still struggle with that. I mean, you know, my new book, From Crime to Crime, a collection of mystery short stories, is out. And it's still hard, you know, when I get a good review, I think, well, they sort of liked it. Yeah. I still have some of that where criticism of the material can be hard for me because I associate so much sense of my own value, lovability, and self-worth. But it's much better than it used to be.
Yes.
I used to live and die based on reviews. And so that has been a really important part of my journey, I think.
Yeah, boy, you know, just even as a teacher, teachers get reviewed too.
And, oh, I know.
And so I know what that is. It's you can get 99 raves and one really critical negative review, and it's so hard not to elevate that one critical one and have that be the whole thing that dominates your consciousness.
Well, I think depending on how you were raised, what your family dynamics were, the criticism feels true. And the praise, you know, in my case, I always feel like, well, you know, I fooled them. But if somebody says, well, I wasn't so impressed, I think to myself, ah, got me, you know.
Yeah.
I either feel that or else I get angry and I go, now who is this bum? You know, when I used to teach at UCLA and I'd get usually really very positive evals. I mean, I have no complaints. But there'd always be one eval where they're like, I don't think he was that great. And I go, where was that guy sitting? Did I say something to him?
Yeah, right.
Does he have an axe to grind? What's going on?
Yeah.
It's very funny.
Yeah.
And the thing that I learned in therapy, to be honest, when people go, wow, you know, how much has it helped you? How much have you changed? After, you know, 17 years of therapy as a patient, I can tell you that I'm as neurotic and insecure as I ever was. I just don't hassle myself about it anymore. And that is a tremendous change for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sense of being okay with me is the biggest growth. I mean, here at 57, I feel like for the first time, I'm really comfortable in my own skin. I mean,
yeah.
It's just who I am.
Yeah.
And that's a tremendous relief, as opposed to in my early years in therapy, I had this fantasy there was this perfectible version of me that if I just did enough therapy, I'd get there.
Yes.
And that's a real trap. And I also, you know, tell, you know, colleagues and interns, you know, be careful that you don't give your patients the message that, you know, there's a perfectible version of them in the future that will then be lovable and worthwhile, that they're lovable and worthwhile now, you know, just the way they are.
Good point. Good point. Is there a particular model or theory of psychotherapy that you're working out of?
Well, I work out of a blend of two. My initial training was in Gestalt. I trained with David Gorton for about 6 years. And Gestalt was very good for me. I'd always been, and still am a lot of the times, up in my head. And with Gestalt, I would, you know, learned about my breathing and body awareness and staying in the moment. It was very helpful. But at the time for me, after being in practice as a therapist for about 3 or 4 years, I began to miss some of what I thought was a crucial developmental component. And so I went back and did supervision for 6 years with Bob Stollero, who is one of the proponents of intersubjectivity theory. It's a little bit of an offshoot of Kohut self-psychology, and it has a much more analytical and developmental aspect to it. And so now, you know, I used to do, as a therapist, you know, a lot of the Gestalt exercises, you know, empty chair, that kind of thing.
Yes.
I don't do that anymore. I'm very grateful for the experience I had as a Gestalt therapist, but I probably see myself much more as an intersubjectivity theorist now, you know, and coming much more out of a self-psychology framework. And I like the combination of the two for me.
Yes, yeah. I think a lot of people have gone through that sort of an evolution of starting with something like Gestalt and then feeling like they needed to get deeper and the sort of more modern offshoots of psychoanalysis seem to provide that for people. What are the challenges of working with creative people in Hollywood?
Well, there are many, many challenges. I think unlike most people, my patients do work that is perceived and seen and marketed to the public at large. Their work is critiqued, reviewed. People go to see it in droves or stay away in droves, you know. So their successes and failures, both personal and professional, are played out on a more public stage, which sort of intensifies the heat, if you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
of what they're going through. If you are a very successful film director and your son or daughter is bulimic or having substance problems or, you know, gets a DUI, that's a very different experience than if you're a bricklayer in Dayton, Ohio, and your son or daughter gets a DUI. It's not in the newspaper. It's not in the tabloids. So there's that huge public focus. And secondarily, you know, to be honest with you, I think in my experience, many people, creative people, not all, but many, come to Hollywood in search of an approving parent. And it's the worst place in the world to find one. And so creative people tend to make the audience, a studio, their agent, into a parent figure that they have to constantly appease or impress to maintain the connection, the emotional tie.
That's interesting because I think most of us have a stereotype that you have to have a really big ego or be extremely narcissistic to make it in Hollywood. So,
well, the thing is, you kind of do and you don't. A friend of mine said that, sort of talking about writers, he said they're egomaniacs with low self-esteem. And that's really a great description. I mean, you do have to have a certain amount of grandiosity to be a writer or director or movie star. You do have to have a certain amount of narcissism. Again, in defense of people in the entertainment industry, I would argue that the narcissism that's necessary to say, gee, give me $150 million because I want to direct this movie, isn't that different from the narcissism that says, give me $150 million, I want to be your president. I mean, most achieving people have a very large amount of narcissism and grandiosity. And Goethe said that writing, for example, is so difficult, you need the hubris to believe that the world cannot live without what you're doing. Because it's so hard to do.
Yeah.
And so I don't have quite the problem with the narcissism or the ego, because you find narcissism and egotism, you know, in big earning CEOs and lawyers and, you know what I'm saying, most captains of industry.
Sure.
Hardly have what I call small egos. In fact, if anything, I remember one time a reporter from the Los Angeles Business Journal asked me a couple questions about all these titans of industry like Jack Welch and those guys all publishing these sort of self-congratulatory autobiographies about how they became rich and famous.
Right.
And to me, they have the vanity of actors. You know what I mean?
It's yeah.
Like I'd be hard-pressed to say, well, gee, you know, some poor screenwriter has more narcissism than someone like that. That's foolish. So to me, the hardest thing, if you're a creative person, is dealing with the insecurities of the business, number one, and the fact that the raw materials of your work are your interior life. You know, if a bricklayer is depressed that day, he doesn't even know it's depression usually, and he'll go to work and the bricks will still be there, and no matter what his frame of mind, he can lay the bricks. But if you're a writer, the raw materials, your bricks, are your internal worlds of experience, your feelings. And so as a result, how you feel affects how you work very, very much. And so if your marriage is in trouble or you're financially strapped or the critics have slammed the last three things you've done, it's a tremendous burden to try to stay focused and do your work, particularly as the marketplace changes and there's a new trend every week. I mean, the ground is never steady under your feet. So you have the same issues everybody else has, and you have it in an industry that's changing and swirling around all the time.
Oh, I can just imagine that. You know, I'm wondering, too, if everybody there is creative. One of my favorite writers and screenwriters is Elmore Leonard,
mm-hmm.
who I'm sure you must know.
Oh, absolute wonderful writer.
Yeah, and he's got such an eye for psychopaths and an ear for their dialogue. And you're probably familiar with his book, which was turned into a movie called Get Shorty.
Oh, sure.
And in that story, there's this East Coast mafioso, and he comes to Hollywood to collect on a loan for his loan shark boss and decides that the Hollywood director gig looks attractive and easy, and he ends up being very successful because he's shrewd and he's got a lot of moxie. So I'm wondering, how plausible is this scenario in your experience? In other words, are there certain types of people who have a lot of hustle but who are not particularly creative who manage to con their way into one or another Hollywood niches?
I would say there's a great deal of those, particularly among studio executives and producers mm-hmm. and managers. I would say that easily half of the most successful big shots in Hollywood are not creative in the traditional sense. They're not interested in that. These are people whose model is Sammy Glick from What Makes Sammy Run, you know.
Yeah.
They're people who, you know, Bud Schulberg, who wrote that, always talks about the fact that when he wrote What Makes Sammy Run, Sammy was a model of what you didn't want to be. And now young Hollywood producers and executives come up to him and go, God, I loved your book. I want to be just like Sammy. And so that kind of, you know, take no prisoners, hustle, 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 you know, it's stereotypical, but it's true. Those kinds of people often thrive in Hollywood. I think because the entertainment industry is so, you know, it's so embedded in a bowl of fear that anyone who seems like they're sure and they know what they're doing attracts a lot of focus. People go, gee, this guy's on a train that's leaving a station. I want to be on that train.
Fascinating.
And so even, you see what I'm saying? So it
yeah.
feels like that. Where, you know, the I always think of that thing that Bertrand Russell said, the problem with the world is that the stupid are cocksure and the intelligent are full of doubt. And most creative people are full of doubt. They're you know, ambivalent, and they're worried, and they think, gee, maybe I could make this better, and, ooh, I wonder if this really works, or... Whereas a lot of sort of less creative but much more ambitious types are more like a bullet. You know, they're just like, well, let's go, bang. And Hollywood is so fear-based that they respond to that, which is why so many kinds of hustler types often rise to the top quickly.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that question is some years ago I met somebody who's exactly that. He was a hustler. I think he had been like some kind of a street hustler. And he's now a very successful TV director. I won't say his name, but you would recognize it if I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
the thing is, talent is the least important thing. I mean, the world's full of talented people. Hollywood is such a difficult environment that you're much better off having moxie, luck, and connection. Mm-hmm. The least important thing is talent. And the only thing, in my experience, with my most successful patients, is that if you work really, really hard, that offsets a lot of those other traits. I mean, some of my most successful writer, director, and actor patients are very insecure, and they're wonderful people, and they're very neurotic, and they're very self-doubting, but their work ethic is so great that they've achieved a level of success that a lot of kind of non-creative schmucks have achieved just by being schmucks, mm-hmm. you know. So being a hard worker and having a real vision and never giving up balances the scales against those who I think are just a little more mercenary.
Yeah, and maybe this accounts for some of the dreck that we see on TV. I seem to recall there was a period in which cocaine was particularly rife in the Hollywood scene.
Oh yeah, in the 70s. When I was on Welcome Back, Hotter, on the ABC lot, it was so funny because cocaine was rampant. All the, you know, writer staffs and everybody, all the stars. It was considered kind of a safe drug in a funny kind of way. But it was what I always used to find so humorous is that security was pretty tight at the studio. And if someone was coming on to visit, whether it was a studio executive or your relative, whatever, you had to call down to the kiosk where the parking lot was and get them a drive-on pass. There was only one guy who had an eternal drive-on pass, and that was Charlie, the cocaine supplier. He had a standing drive-on pass for every day.
Amazing.
Which I thought was so funny.
Amazing. Has that changed? Or is
oh, yeah. Absolutely. No. There's still a lot of substance use in Hollywood, but the long-term effects and even some of the short-term rigors of cocaine use has made it less tempting for a lot of creative people. Mm-hmm. But it's still pretty rampant. There's still a lot of substance use in Hollywood. The pressure, people use substances to self-medicate.
Yes.
But again, I have many friends who are doctors and lawyers, and they believe that in their world, the substance use has gotten rampant, too. I think right now, where the culture is, from a sociological standpoint, in terms of the competition and the ethic of more, 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 I think in almost every achieving profession, you're seeing a rise in substance use as a way to deal with the stress, as a way to self-medicate. I mean, it's a shame, but that's what you see. And, you know, it doesn't have to be some guy on the street you're getting it from. Look at the rise of prescription drugs. I mean, you know, the amount of prescription drug use and, you know, abuse is at an all-time high in the country right now.
Yes. One of the things that intrigued me when I heard you on NPR was that you have such a finely differentiated understanding of the roles and the psychology and the pitfalls of writers versus actors versus directors.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of each of those three categories as you've...
Well, you know, learned. I certainly don't want to speak as though I'm on high here. I'm just saying from my own experience. As first of all, as a writer, I can speak from my own experience. You know, writers tend to value insight and intellect, and their struggles tend to be more based on having felt kind of insecure and an outsider. And the big struggle, I think, even if you're a successful writer, is that you're, what you have to bring to the table is not so appreciated by the corporate structure of the business. I think with actors, in my experience, you know, actors have the same kinds of insecurity growing up often, and often struggle with a feeling of fraudulence. You know, they struggle as actors for years and years, and all of a sudden, boom, they're on a television show or in a film, and they become very well known and very lauded for their ability, but they're often quite suspicious about it. Somehow it doesn't seem, you know, like it's enough. I think one of the reasons you see actors doing like things for the environment and racing to Darfur and stuff like that, people think, well, it's just an extension of their egoism. I don't see it that way. I see it as they're trying to justify their existence because they're ridiculously overpaid for what they do, and they're suspicious of how much value it brings to the world.
Mm-hmm.
None of this is true for directors. Directors seem to be the most comfortable with the idea that their vision should be realized on screen, that if we were in World War II, there would be the ones who'd be the generals, you know.
Yes.
And they have insecurities and doubts too, God knows. Usually what that has to do with is more the sort of panoply of great directors. You know, if you're a director nowadays and you're making a film, what you think is, oh my God, how does this compare to Willie Wyler? How does this compare to Billy Wilder? How does this compare to Orson Welles? You know, directors are very conscious of the list of great directors. And when you're directing, you know, Dude, Where's My Car? Part 6, you say to yourself, gee, I'm never going to get a chance to be David Lean. When am I going to get to make Lawrence of Arabia? And so the sense that you're never going to achieve your vision, that regardless of how much money you're making, you're working beneath your gifts, is a big issue for directors. And, you know, and I see that as well. Now, oftentimes, too, I see that directors are made a little nervous and intimidated by the screenplays that they're working with or the writers they're working with. Directors are often worried that the writer is smarter than them. But the director has all the power in film. Not in television, as I said, but in film. So they sort of trust their intuition and their insight as being, you know, sort of having the guiding vision of the film. And directing is a very hard job. As much as I think writing is really, really hard, I think in terms of your ego, the hardest thing is acting because your rejection is personal. You stand there, you do a scene, and people don't choose you. So you're rejected to your face.
Yeah.
Devastating. You know, writing, very hard too, because when you send the material out, you know, it's like I said, you're sending your child out in the world and you hope people are nice to it. And it's really, really difficult to deal with the response. I think directors have the problem where they are overly lauded for the success of a project and overly criticized for its failure. A good example, certainly this person is not my patient or I wouldn't talk about him, is M. Night Shyamalan, the guy who did Sixth Sense. his last couple movies haven't done too well, and so he's very much victim of that thing in Hollywood where they put you on a pedestal, they instantly make you the next big thing because of the success of The Sixth Sense.
Yes.
And then when the succeeding films don't do well, they not only drop in everyone's estimation, but then they run back and reevaluate the film that they loved and said, you know, it wasn't that good after all.
Mm.
You know, so you're very much in public getting slammed, and he's certainly going through that now.
Wow. Yeah, I marvel at directors. You liken them to generals, and you watch a movie like Iron Man or the latest Indiana Jones, and those screen credits just roll on and on and on and on, and I just marvel, you know, how do you pull together that many people and have them all working together on a project, you know, that ends up with some kind of a hopefully successful result.
Yeah, or a cohesive result. No,
yeah.
It's quite difficult. I mean, if you're a director, you're making decisions from 6 in the morning till midnight every day. And hopefully you know how to delegate, and hopefully the people who are running your CGI division, you know, have a good leader, and the people who are doing all your, you know, second AD is a good guy. And, you know, you need to have lots of really talented people working at their best, but you have to be the one that makes sure that what this unit over here is doing doesn't conflict with what this unit over here is doing.
Yes.
And on top of which, you have to deal with the actors and their egos and their concerns. And they're valid concerns, because the writer and director, their faces aren't up there 16 feet high. You know, when people make fun of movie stars, I always think to myself, yeah, but they're the ones whose faces are up there. And they don't want to get into being a turkey any more than anyone else would want to be in a turkey, because it's so public, you know. And so, of course, they're going to be fanatic about how they're being photographed, or very fanatic about what lines they're saying or how their character is coming across. And you know, so it's easy to sort of make fun of that as, you know, well, it's just a conceited actor. But it's when you think of the stakes, and when you think of the fact that, you know, the public doesn't sit there watching a movie going, look at that stupid writer or look at that stupid director. They watch the movie and they go, wow, look at that stupid Adam Sandler. He thinks that's funny?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they have to bear the brunt of what the audience is experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have some sympathy for them trying to protect themselves.
Yeah. You've spoken a lot about fear, and I wonder if the level of fear isn't actually rising due to changes in the business model. It seems like there's a threat from the internet, and also it's like, as in publishing, it's like you have to have a blockbuster, and only the blockbuster is going to get funded, et cetera.
Yeah, no, that's very true. The business model has changed radically. And it seems to me a silly one. It doesn't, you know, I'm not a businessman. I'm about as far from an understanding of the financial world as anyone could be. But even I think it makes more sense to make 20 movies that cost $30 million and make $100 million each than to make 4 movies that cost $200 million and need to make $600 million to be in profit. But that's the business model. And primarily it's because, and I think the average person doesn't realize this, but certainly this is the way the industry thinks, movies have become essentially platforms for video games and merchandising.
Oh, boy.
And so Iron Man's success isn't just that it made whatever it's going to make worldwide, probably $500 million or something, but in the merchandising and the video games, it will move into the billions. And so as a result, a studio would much rather spend $200 million making Iron Man than $20 million making, you know, some small film that brings back maybe $30 million in profit. See, to anyone else, they'd go, wow, that's a great return. It cost $20 and it brought back $50. But in Hollywood's understanding, once that $50 is in, you're done. It's not going to make you any more money. There's no merchandising or video games that come from In the Bedroom or There Will Be Blood. But with Iron Man and Raiders of the Lost Ark and Batman, the movie is just there to motivate people to go buy the action figures and the video games. And so the business model has changed. And I think that's very frustrating for creative people who want to make, you know, meaningful films and or meaningful television shows, because the business model has changed so much.
Well, this opens up a whole another direction that I would just love to talk to you. We could talk a lot more and a lot longer about that and the whole question of, you know, whether the bad drives out the good, if this is another example of that. But we're going
to... Well, you know, the funny thing is, to end on a more positive note, the good always shows up. You know what I mean? It shows up. It finds light. If you shut the door on the good, it comes in through the window. I've just seen that a million times. One of my favorite quotes is someone asked Harold Clurman, the Broadway director, does it bother you all the bad plays that are on Broadway? And he said, no. Bad work is the manure from which good work comes. And I think that's a great quote.
Yes, yes, and thank you for that reminder, that ray of light. Now, even though you're working as a psychotherapist, you haven't stopped writing. You mentioned this book. Your most recent book is called From Crime to Crime, Mind-Boggling Tales of Murder and Mystery. And it's an interesting genre that you explained kind of at the beginning. I didn't realize it was a genre, but I guess there's a genre of a crime happens in a closed room in which nobody could have come in or gotten out, and so how did it happen? Am I describing that correctly?
Yeah, the stories, these are classic whodunits. I've always liked classic mystery stories, particularly whether there's what's called a locked room mystery, which is the no way for the crime to have happened, and yet it did. And there's also a form called armchair mysteries, where a group of people sitting around, hopefully with interesting and humorous personalities, try to solve a crime just using their minds. And I've always liked writing whodunits. My first mystery story, actually the first fiction that ever was published, I published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine way back in 1978. And I've always liked writing crime stories, so I'm very pleased about this new collection, From Crime to Crime, because most of the stories feature a group of characters based on me and three of my friends. We used to meet every Sunday for deli and beer and just to talk about the issues of the day, sort of like a poor man's McLaughlin group, you know?
Yeah, that's great.
And then what would happen if we had to solve a mystery every week? And so that's what I did. And I'm very pleased with how the books turned out. I think if people like classic whodunits, if they like Agatha Christie and Monk or Murder, She Wrote, it's very much in the light, cerebral style of those kinds of mysteries.
Yes, yes. And you've even got one that alludes to Freud and one with Einstein.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Einstein is in one of them. And
yeah, no, I have a lot of fun in this book. I really, really do. And I've been very gratified because the response has been really good. And I've garnered some really nice blurbs from writers I respect a lot in the genre.
Excellent.
So I'm very pleased, and I'm hoping to do more, but I'm very pleased with the book.
You've also written a novel I saw on the flyleaf, a futuristic thriller called City Wars.
Yeah, that was published by Bantam a number of years ago, and they're trying to develop it as a film now, which that was a fun project. I came up with that years ago and wrote it years ago, and it was sort of based on, I was watching a football game one time. I'm a big football fan, and I was watching Pittsburgh versus Cleveland. We've had this rivalry for years and years, Steelers versus the Browns. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be weird if Pittsburgh and Cleveland really went to war? Not like their football teams, but the cities themselves. And so I imagined a future where New York and Chicago were at war. They were separate city-states like Athens and Sparta.
Yes.
And they actually were at war. And that's City Wars. That's the book. And right now a guy who produced a recent movie called Jumper is trying to develop it as a film.
Hey, well, I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
Well, thanks.
That would be great.
Yeah, and I'm retired. I don't do any of this stuff. You know what I mean? I give them the book, and if they can put it together, great. I'm not writing it. I'm having nothing to do with it. I'm just sort of in the sidelines here, hoping that it does well.
Okay, well, look, as we wind down here, you've made some career changes in your life, and I know some of my listeners are in that process or thinking about being in that process. What's your advice for any of my listeners contemplating making a shift?
The most important thing is to cut out the noise of your life and be quiet with yourself for a while. The thing that helped me, and you don't have to do this, but when I was in the Himalayas, I had many, many weeks sitting up in a Himalayan village with no distractions, not having to do my daily job, not having to talk to my lawyer or my agent or my manager, which I had to do when I was in Los Angeles. And I thought, how do I feel? What do I miss? What do I yearn for? What am I going to do with my one and only precious life that I know of? How do I want to spend it? Do I like the people I'm with now? How do I want to feel when I get up in the morning? And most of the time, we're all so busy completing tasks that we don't have any space to think about those things. And many, many people in history have sat down and done that, you know, whether you're Van Gogh or just a regular guy, and gone, you know, I don't want to live this life anymore. I want to live that life.
Okay.
And it is, I think, important for everyone to take seriously, if you have a yearning to take a pilgrimage away from the life you're living now to one that you think will be more fulfilling. You owe your life to no one but you. And so I think you need to really sit down and do that.
Those are great words of wisdom to close on. Dennis Palumbo, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, David.
I hope you were as fascinated by this look behind the Hollywood scene as I was. You heard how impressed I was that Dennis did a stint as a stand-up comedian. In my own prime as a university teacher, I had a reputation for my sense of humor, and I can recall times when I was on a roll and I had the class in stitches. Some students even suggested I should consider stand-up. In fact, there was a period in my life where I was doing a fair amount of traveling, conducting focus groups as part of my market research business. And as a way of adding some fun into these business trips, I would visit the local comedy clubs on the evenings I wasn't working. These visits would fan my fantasies of getting up on that stage. I wonder if I might have seen Dennis Palumbo in one of those comedy clubs on my travels. I don't know. The closest I ever came to doing something like that was the two occasions when I did try my hand as a stage hypnotist, and both of those experiences were fairly harrowing, and I've recounted them in early episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio. Recounts that hopefully were humorous, in fact. I discovered that there's a big difference between being funny slash entertaining in front of a captive audience such as you have in a university classroom and a voluntary paying audience that you would encounter in a nightclub. So my hat's off to Dennis for having had the guts to get up and try his hand at it and then to have it take him to the place he was trying to get to at that time, which was to be a writer. I also love Dennis's observation that intelligent, creative types tend to be the ones who are more likely to be self-questioning and to struggle with self-doubt. I think I like that observation and agree with it, partly because it describes my own personality. And finally, I was interested in Dennis's observation that the result of his own 17 years of personal therapy has not been the achievement of a perfected self, but rather an acceptance of the self that he is. I think I've come to pretty much a similar place in my own life, and I think that sort of self-acceptance may be arrived at by various paths, whether as a result of psychotherapy, meditation, or simply the maturational process that can come with aging.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah, it's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Be sure to catch Shrink Wrap Radio Live number 10 on Saturday morning, June 28th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. You can participate live with us by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. And you'll be able to call us on the phone number that you'll see there or join in on the web chat. I hope you'll be there. Among other things, my friend Jerry Trumbull and I will be discussing an article that appeared in The Atlantic about the impact of Google and other digital media on the brain. You might also want to listen to my interview with Dr. Michelle Kraske on my other podcast at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. I interviewed her there about her world-class research on anxiety and its treatment. I want to thank the folks who've made PayPal donations through our Top Spots widget on our site. Be sure to check them out. And please consider making your own $20 donation in exchange for an opportunity to promote your favorite blog or website there. Just go to shrinkwrapradio.com and look at the top right-hand side of the page. The list of interview transcripts continues to grow. Won't you join our other volunteers in doing a transcription? Just drop me an email if you'd like to help out in that way. As usual, the sponsors for this show are Mevio and GoDaddy. You can check out all of our GoDaddy discount codes on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. For example, using the code SHRINK3 at checkout will get you a 10% discount on any domain names you purchase.
Hi, this is Christopher Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Once again, we're running a bit long here, so just a few quick listener emails. Longtime listener Cody in Israel writes, "Hi, David. I enjoyed very much your number 157, The Psychology of Second Life podcast." And then she gives me a link to an article in Business Week, a recent issue of Business Week by the same author, Wagner James Au. So you might want to take a look for that article. She says, "I think this Business Week article can be a nice complement to your wonderful podcast. I also enjoyed the second interview with Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. She has such a clean, understandable show performance. Have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much for your wonderful podcast, Cody." Cody, it's always good to hear from you. And then next we hear from somebody about the from one of the Top Spots plugs, the one of about Get the Dream. It's Laura who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks so much for your Top Spots plugs on the last two shows. We really appreciate it and have seen some visitors coming from your site." So thank you, those of you who've gone and visited their site. She goes on to say, "I loved the Second Life interview. It certainly opened my eyes to the variety of interests, people, and possibilities that can exist in a virtual world. You mentioned the idea of doing an interview with us. Our company founder, Chance Cole, is a gifted speaker and always enjoys doing interviews. He has an interesting background and is very passionate about the intersection of science and personal development. I would be happy to set up an appointment for you to chat with him at any time. Also, I realize that our free sleep gift was just moved to a different URL. Please take advantage of it here. Regards, Laura." And she gives the link to their free sleep gift. So I downloaded it. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, though. But you'll find it at www.getthedream.com/free_gift.php. And I've got a little frog in my throat. I'm right on the cusp of coming down with a cold. I'm trying to fight it off. I don't know if you can hear that in my voice or not. And so, Laura, I will be in touch. Probably will want to do an interview with Chance. And moving right along, we hear from Anna the Man, who is a regular listener, again in Israel, and he writes, "Hi, David. Recently, I heard the shows with my three shrinks and with Jill Taylor. I reviewed them here," and he refers us to his blog, which you'll find at annisaman.blogspot.com. And Anne is a man is spelled A-N-N-E-I-S-A-M-A-N .blogspot.com. And you'll find his reviews there. And so I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And by the way, I think I'm all caught up on emails, so I need some new ones. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where the name is ShrinkPod. You can use a microphone with My Chingo on our site. Just click on the My Chingo link. And we have a message phone at 206-337-0622. So thanks again to writer and psychotherapist Dennis Palumbo for his insights into the world of Hollywood. And if everything goes according to schedule, my next show will feature an interview with spiritual author Steve Riles about his book, Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.